Chapter 17. First Week at Work. The languished joy of Mohonk, where we had had breakfast on cedar tables in the mornings and spent our evenings laughing with drink and new friendships in front of a roaring bonfire next to the lake, became, as all things do, a memory. The next week, we were on the 17th floor of Rockefeller Center, a beehive of activity and stinging rejection, where we had to learn, and learn fast. We were all just kids back then. Well, not kids really, but we were very, very immature. I got to know my fellow freshmen very quickly, Jay Moore, Dave Attell, and Sarah Silverman. One of them I loved, and one of them I hated. I hated Dave Attell, but I only hated him because I loved Sarah Silverman, and she loved Dave Attell. The first year was tough. Sarah, Jay, and I had been hired as featured players. It was a tough position to be in, languishing somewhere just shy of being a full writer and a full performer. We were expected to write sketches for the big dogs, but we were also allowed to write ourselves small parts in the sketches. The problem was, we were stand-up comics, and we were competing with actual sketch writers who knew what they were doing. These writers were very smart and literate, and many of them had attended Ivy League schools. The roster was made up of Ian Maxtone Graham, Lou Morton, Dave Mandel, Steve Corin, Marilyn Suzanne Miller, Steve Luckner, and, the brightest and funniest of them all, Jim Downey. You just didn't get much smarter than these young lions of comedy. That's why I was so flattered when I learned that they had given me the nickname Einstein. Hey, nice sketch this week, Einstein. I bet you have some good ideas for Alec Baldwin, huh, Einstein? Hey, Einstein, we're hungry. Can you get us a bunch of sandwiches, Einstein? That kind of thing. I was honored that these smart, educated folks had given me the moniker, but the truth was, I was nowhere near as smart as Alfred Einstein. Shoot, I wasn't even as smart as that new scientist, the one with the wheelchair and the funny way of talking. But I wasn't going to let the eggheads and blue stockings in the writer's room know that. Despite the high praise of my co-workers, I had trouble getting any of my sketches on the air. But I remembered what Downey had said, and stayed close to the Fab Four, and their leader, my friend, Adam Sandler. Some of the writers would give me bit parts and skits, which allowed me to keep my job. Ian Maxtone Graham, Adam McKay, Steve Higgins, and Tim Herlihy were especially kind, and Sandler was always sure to throw me a bone. One time, I came close to blowing it with Sandler, because I was a rookie and not used to the nuances of acting in sketches. Probably the toughest part of acting, and something you never learn in stand-up, is having the sharp wit to react when someone calls you by a different name. Sandler had written me into a sketch as his co-star. It was a huge opportunity for me, and I was determined not to blow it like I had blown every other opportunity in the joke I called my life. I studied that sketch from front to back, which I had been told by Downey was the correct order in which to study it. It was my big break, and I wasn't about to screw it up. On Saturday night, I was nervous but ready, like a great athlete. We were trying out the sketch at dress rehearsal. The only way you got the sketch on the real live show at 11:30 p.m. was to destroy at dress at 8 p.m. Sandler hit me with his first line. "Hey, Frank, did you hear about that meteor hurtling toward the Earth?" Now, by this time, I lived in the same apartment building, the Regency House, that Adam lived in, and we shared an office, so I was good friends with him. And he never called me Frank. He always called me Norm. Naturally, when he called me Frank, I didn't respond. And so Adam repeated his line. But I noticed there was an edge in his voice. If I'd been thinking, I'd have realized at this point that I was Frank, because Adam and I were the only two people in the sketch. But I wasn't thinking. I was looking at things around the set. One table in particular. It was made of brown wood and reminded me of a table I'd once seen in a table store. So the two of us didn't say anything at all. About 20 minutes passed, and finally the show ended. Boy, Adam was really steamed at me about that one. And Lauren was, too. Every Wednesday, we would submit our sketches. And this is where the most curious thing would happen. From the beginning, I had submitted my answering machine sketch, which I knew would be a blockbuster, and in which I had a starring role. The sketch was based on the first joke I ever told on stage, and was the funniest thing ever. Seriously. I wrote the sketch and brought it to the table every single week. Some weeks, it would get no laughs at all. Others, it would get 2, or 3, or 4. That's the way comedy works. They either hate you, or they don't completely hate you. You can never tell which it will be beforehand. Every time I submitted the answering machine sketch, I would be sure to write Sarah Silverman in, as she was struggling, like me, and any airtime was valuable to her. Also, using Sarah gave me a dynamite end to the sketch. Sarah would say, "Boy, mister, these answering machines are really annoying." And I would say, "Frankly, lady, I don't give a damn." And then give Sarah a big smooch. This gave the sketch a big laugh at the end by spoofing a well-known motion picture, and it also allowed me to give a big smooch to Sarah, whom I was falling deeply in love with. At the time, Sarah and Dave Attell ruled the New York stand-up scene. Sarah, with her sly subversive satire masked by the sweetest of deliveries. And Attell, a joke machine to rival Dangerfield himself. She was elegant and unafraid. He was rumpled, unshaven, and a chain smoker. They were the Bogey and Bacall of the New York comedy circle. What chance did I have? What woman was going to choose Alfred Einstein over Humphrey Bogart? Still, I vowed I would win Sarah's love. No one at SNL knew more about matters of the heart than David Spade, so I asked his advice. "Just ask her out, buddy," Spade told me. Just ask her out. So simple and yet so incredibly complex. No wonder David Spade was so good with the ladies. I was pulling an all-nighter in the writer's room, trying to finish the answering machine sketch for Wednesday's read-through, when I spotted Sarah in the hallway. I decided to make my intentions known. "You're dreadful pretty, Sarah," I said, "and I'd be honored if you would lay down with me. And not in the restroom, either. I will take you out to a restaurant, and you can order beefsteak that I will pay for. We will coo and whisper and smile meaningful smiles, and we will reduce the whole world and its people to our small table and the two of us. And then, afterward, I will take you to my bed, and we will be like swine." She ran away, and I realized that I'd made a big mistake. You see, Sarah was a liberated woman, and she didn't need any man to buy her a beefsteak. She made exactly the same salary as I did, minus the 30% that they automatically took off on account of she was a woman. And what a woman. In a way, Sarah's lucky she never met the payroll clerk at SNL, or they might have taken off 60%. The day after my clumsy pass, I was served a restraining order that said I was not allowed to be within 100 yards of my loved one. This made the cameramen on the show furious, because when Sarah and I were in the same sketch, they had to resort to ridiculously wide shots. I fell into a deep depression, heartbroken. About a week later, I walked into the Comedy Cellar to do a set. I had some new material and wanted to try it out. They had recently come out with a new telephone that had its own built-in answering machine. The first thing I saw was the two of them, Dave and Sarah, canoodling at a corner table. They may as well have been up in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. Well, I saw red, and I went over to Colin Quinn. Colin was and is the smartest comedian alive, and a great guy to boot. This was long before he joined the cast of SNL and destroyed my life. "Colin," I said, "you're from New York. Where does a guy go to hire a hitman?" Colin laughed. "What do you want with a hitman?" "Can you keep a secret, Colin? I plan to have Dave Attell murdered, and then, once he's out of the way, convince Sarah to lay down with me." I should have paused to give Colin a chance to answer my question regarding his ability to keep a secret before I spilled my whole plan. As it turned out, Colin Quinn was a huge blabbermouth who wound up prating like a magpie about the entire murder plot as soon as he got the chance. But I didn't know that then. "Don't worry," I said. "There's between $50 and $75 in it for you." "Are you completely serious about this, Norm? I mean, there's plenty of fish in the sea." I knew right away he wasn't talking about fish. Colin was the king of metaphors. He meant there were plenty of ladies in the sea. "No offense, Colin, but the longer it takes for me to listen to your yapping, the longer it will take to have Dave Attell murdered and that very night lay down with Sarah." Colin looked very nervous, but finally said, "All right, I know a guy." Colin called me the next day and said it was all set up. I was to meet the hitman at the corner booth of the Stage Deli the next day at noon. I asked Colin if he could change it to the Carnegie Deli, because it is a far superior deli. He said it was too late, so I thanked him, but he had to have heard the bitter disappointment in my voice. I mean, if you're going to meet a hitman at a Midtown deli, why the Stage Deli? Why not the Carnegie Deli? The next day, I sat in the Stage Deli and waited for the hitman to arrive. He was late, so I spent my time thinking about the delicious pastrami on rye they had at the Carnegie Deli and how I would not be eating one today. I saw a police officer enter the joint, and I got nervous. When he slipped into the booth across from me, I got really nervous. "You, Norm?" he asked. "I'm not talking to any coppers," I said. "Who's a copper?" the cop asked. "You are." "I'm no copper. Where'd you get a ridiculous idea like that?" "Well, you're wearing a police uniform." I was very good at spotting cops. He looked down at himself and saw that I was right and began sweating profusely and stuttering and hitting his forehead twice with the palm of his hand and saying, "Stupid, stupid!" It took him a few minutes to compose himself, but finally he said, "Oh, this. You see, I've been walking the beat the last 10 years, and I just got promoted to undercover cop, but you know what they say, old habits die hard." He seemed relaxed again. "So you're an undercover cop," I said. "Why should I talk to you?" Well, he started the whole sweating and stuttering and hitting his forehead routine all over again. I just got up to leave when he blurted out, "I'm a bad cop, a dirty cop." "You are?" "Yeah, of course I am. That's what makes me such a good hitman. I have my own gun, and nobody ever suspects a cop." The waitress came up and addressed the hitman with the police costume on. "Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to keep your voice down. You're frightening many of the customers." The hitman had been speaking very loudly in a sort of panic. I would find out later that he wasn't a bad cop at all. I mean, he was a bad cop in the sense that he was no good at being a cop, but he was not a corrupt cop. He pulled out a large tape recorder and hit the play button and the record button simultaneously, and we began hammering out a deal. He would murder Dave Attell, and in return I would give him $355. We haggled for well over an hour before finally settling on the $355 figure, which made me very angry. After he arrested me and I realized he could have just accepted my first offer and saved us both a lot of time. When I got to the precinct, they told me I was allowed one phone call. "Hello, Colin. It's Norm. You're from New York. Where does a guy go to hire an attorney?"